Hello, friends. This is Out of This World Radio and Television with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW in Bellevue, Washington, on 1150 AM, just outside Seattle here in the United States, in North America in the Milky Way galaxy. The program focuses on out-of-this-world information, including psychic phenomena, UFOs, metaphysics, and predictions for the coming years in Seattle, the United States, and beyond. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and to make this planet a far better and much happier place. And I know that with everyone's help, we can do it. We can make this planet a better place. Out of This World Radio is the fastest growing spiritual, psychic, and UFO radio program in the world, with listeners in over 60 countries. And I know today's show will be, you'll find it really fascinating. During the first hour, from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I'll be interviewing Michael Tellinger, a fascinating gentleman who's the author of Slave Species and some other fascinating books. He's on the line now. He's coming to us live from South Africa. This interview should be really incredible, I promise you. The next hour, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., I'll be interviewing Randy Kramer, who has lived on Mars and the Moon for the last 20 years. He was with the American Secret Space Program. And I plan to ask him what it was like to live on Mars, what he saw there, and especially about the indigenous human populations living on the South Pole of Mars. When I spoke with Randy last year, he said there were 6 or 7 million people living on Mars. Yes, that's correct. And I'll be asking about that. And on the Moon, he said there's another 4 or 5 million people living on the Moon. But that should be truly out of this world. To listen during the show, if you're on the Internet, please go to www.1150.com. KKNW.com and click Listen Live. And after the show, please listen at outofthisworld1150.com. If you're in Seattle or Vancouver, beautiful Vancouver, Canada, you can listen to us on 1150 AM, KKNW. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Ted Marr, OTW Radio. Before we start, I'd like to thank everyone so much for your support. And I'd also especially like to thank the wonderful Crystal Bookstore in Tacoma, Washington, and Orion Tech Computers of Bend, Oregon. I'd also like to thank the many wonderful sponsors, people who sponsored my show and helped me out, including Carol, who's been designing my website and providing wonderful support. My dear friend Michiko Hayashi, as well as Hiro Emoto, Mrs. Emoto, and Dr. Yasu Nimoto of the Emoto Peace Project and Emoto Office in Tokyo, Japan. My friends in the Galactic Alliance who've been supporting my show. My angelic and earthly family, as well as my wonderful sound engineer, Eric, and my station manager, Eric Crema, without whose help and support this program would not have been possible. I wanted to tell everyone I've started a new spiritual mentoring program. If you'd like to talk to people who have passed on, or you're interested in getting in contact with loved ones, please call or email me. My email address is outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. Out of This World Radio is supported entirely by donations, and for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. We're also looking for sponsors and advertisers for the show, and any advertising on the program will have a worldwide audience in over 60 countries for your goods and services. With that, I'd like to especially thank Judith in California, Marie and Alan on Camino Island, and everyone around the world who's helped me raise consciousness and support this program. Very quickly, I'm having a new television show starting next week. It'll be called Out of This World Television. My first guest will be the wonderful Michiko Hayashi of the Emoto Peace Project, who will be interviewed through modern technology. I'll be here in Seattle in a studio, and she'll be in Tokyo, Japan, and it should be really interesting. I'll be telling you 1 week from today. I'll give you all the details about how to listen to that. But I'll do my first interview next week. It'll be on the internet and available 1 week from today. For those who are interested, I still have beautiful calendars from the Emoto Peace Project from Tokyo. They're full of beautiful pictures of Dr. Emoto's waterwork. I received them recently from Tokyo. If you're interested, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. Or you can call me here in the United States at area code 509-750-9793. Just quickly, a couple of upcoming events. On March 4th and 5th, 2016, I'll be at a speaker at a UFO conference in beautiful ocean shores right on the Pacific here. For those of you in Finland, I'll be speaking at a spiritual conference on the future of humanity in Helsinki on May 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th. Then from June 10th to the 13th, I'll be having my second annual Galactic Wisdom Conference in Olympia, Washington. On August 19th, 20th, and 21st, I'll be a keynote speaker at a worldwide spiritual conference in the Dominican Republic. And then finally, on August 25th, 2016, I'll be taking a group of up to 20 people to see the incredible John of God in Brazil. He's a fantastic medium, and he's able to put people in touch with their spiritual guides so they can get some wonderful healing. Very quickly before we go on to Michael, he's on the line now in South Africa. I'd like to make a quick prayer for the for Fukushima. Although the world media has almost totally ignored Fukushima, I think it's still a problem, and they still need our help. So I'm asking everyone listening to please say this water prayer to help the people of children of Fukushima. If you can, please say it three times. And when you do it, please send lots of love and light to the people and children of Fukushima, because it does help. It's based on the Ho'oponopono, and it was Dr. Masaru Emoto's favorite prayer. The first line is, water, we are sorry. Water, please forgive us. Water, we love you, and water, we thank you. And finally again, water, we are sorry. Water, please forgive us. Water, we love you, and water, we thank you. And finally, water, we are sorry. Water, please forgive us. Water, we love you, and water, we thank you. The Emoto Peace Project distributes these wonderful children's books around the world to teach children between the ages of 3 and 12 the valuable lessons of love and gratitude. And if you can, I urge everyone to support them. They're doing such wonderful work. Their website is www.emotopeaceproject.net. And finally, I received an email this morning from Norway. I have a lady there, a friend of mine, who's been in contact with the Andromeda Galaxy for decades. And she had an urgent message that she'd like me to read on air. It's only going to take a minute because I want to get to my interview with Michael in South Africa. But it's coming from the Andromeda Galaxy and also from the whales. She said that last weekend that the Andromedans tell her that the U.S. Navy illegally killed 350 whales, thousands of dolphins, and tens of thousands of other sea life, including many, many squid and other sea life at the southern tip of Chile. And this was done as part of a program by President Obama and the U.S. Navy to eliminate up to 5 million dolphins and whales on this planet within the next couple of years. The Andromedans say that this was actually a crime against humanity because these dolphins and whales are beautiful creatures. They have every much as a right to live on this planet as we do. I plan to have a special program on what the new U.S. Navy is doing to eliminate these whales and dolphins and what we can do about it on February 29th from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. I've invited Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada to be part of that discussion. I think he's a good man, and I'm told that he could help. Very quickly, I do have a message also in an email from the Andromedans I'd like to read quickly about that. And this is from this is directly from the Andromedans, and they asked me to read this quickly. Quote, Mother Earth and her inhabitants cannot withstand any more wars and the plundering of her gifts to mankind. They write that whales and dolphins are conscious, breathing, living creatures. They live in the vast ocean, and they're here for a reason. They're here to raise the consciousness of this planet and raise the vibration. By this senseless, needless killing of these animals by your U.S. Navy, you're actually lowering the vibration of this planet, I don't think anyone can tolerate. And they say, the reason why they are being eliminated is because there are those negative forces here on this planet who want to get rid of them, so our vibration of this planet will decrease. So I will be having a program on this in a few weeks, but and there's a lot more I can say, but I want to go now to Michael Tellinger in South Africa. Michael, are you there?
I certainly am. Just listening with great interest to your amazing introduction about all the different activities and amazing information. Oh, fascinating.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Michael. Well, one of these days, I hope to meet you. If South Africa was on the way to Europe, I could stop by and see you in a couple of months. But I think it's a little bit kind of out of the way, sort of. You're at the southern tip of Africa there, I think.
Yeah, we are sort of out of the way. Not as bad as the Australians, but we are, yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I want to give a little bit of background about you to my many listeners around the world. You're the author of four books, a scientist and explorer who's become a real-life Indiana Jones, making groundbreaking discoveries about advanced vanished civilizations at the southern tip of Africa. You're at the founder of the Ubuntu Liberation Movement, a higher consciousness in the Ubuntu Party, with members in over 200 countries. Fantastic. The Ubuntu Party participated in the South African elections on May 7, 2014, under your leadership, and you're now registered as well in the United Kingdom as a political party. You've written some fascinating books, And you've also shared the stage with such wonderful researchers like Graham Hancock. He's been on my show. Wonderful man, Eric Von Doniken, Jim Mars, Robert Temple, David Wilcox, Bob Dean, Gary Cassidy, Project Camelot, Dr. Stephen Greer, Stanton Friedland, Andrew Collins, Klaus Dana, Valerie Yuvov, Samir, I can't pronounce his last name, Osmanagic, and many more.
Osmanagic.
Yeah. You took the words right
Samir Osmanagic.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I read your book, Slave Species of the Gods. I haven't read your Temples of the African Gods yet. But basically, Michael, I want to start an interview now. What led you to this fascinating kind of research? Have you been interested in this your entire life, about the origins of civilization and how we got here?
Yes, I have. You know, it's probably like everybody else that starts this journey. It's just not being satisfied with the answers we get at school and from our teachers. Mm-hmm. And going on your own journey of discovery and realizing that what we're taught at school is far from the truth, and most of it is actually wrapped up sugar-coated poison pills that they give us to swallow throughout our lives at school. Uh-huh. And then your real education starts when you leave school, you know?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, one of the things I've read here that you found was something called the some very ancient stone ruins that were more than 10 million years old, or they were energy devices called the Taurus Stone that crashed the security systems at an airport in July 2013. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please? That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it's throwing it into a pot like that could sound very confusing. So let's just make it simple for your listeners to understand.
Okay.
There are these ancient ruins in southern Africa that cover vast parts of southern Africa, which is South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Mozambique, and further north across the Zambezi into Zambia. But the dense areas where these stone structures, these stone ruins, which have affectionately become known as the stone circles, are in South Africa and Zimbabwe. And these stone circles have been a fascination for explorers and researchers for over 500 years, because the first record that we have of European interaction with these ruins is in the late 1400s, when the Portuguese came around the Cape towards India, and they met local inhabitants, and they saw these stone structures, and they inquired from the local inhabitants at that stage who built them and what they were for, and they were told in very specific terms that the local inhabitants didn't know where those stone circles came from, and they didn't know who built them, but they inhabited them and used them for their own purposes where they found them, and then in the 1800s quite a bit of exploration started, specifically with regard to Great Zimbabwe, which may be known to many of your listeners. It's one of the great ancient ruins in the world, mm-hmm. Ancient complexes. Great Zimbabwe is just phenomenal. And that was the research started quite seriously in the 1800s by the Germans, and some British researchers then followed. And the mystery continued. What they did not know is the absolute abundance of these stone structures scattered throughout southern Africa. Mm-hmm. And in 1891, Theodore Bent, who was one of the leading archaeology researchers at Great Zimbabwe specifically, but Theodore Bent traveled through South Africa, Botswana, and Zimbabwe for, I think it was 2 years, doing research and exploration. And he actually wrote some phenomenal information that is just very quickly forgotten and shoved under the carpet, because it was very revealing that we're dealing with some mysterious ancient history here that is not always friendly or resonant with a Eurocentric kind of message that the European explorers want to send about Southern Africa and the savages. Sure. And you know that they have no knowledge of anything. So, and in 1891, Theodore Bent estimated that there were about 4,000 of these stone structures scattered throughout Southern Africa, and that was from horseback, riding on horseback, which in those days was quite a tough thing to do.
Sure.
You know, you had lions and wild animals that want to eat you around every bend.
Sure.
It's not like that today, but it was 100 years ago, certainly. Mm-hmm. And then by 1974 or around there, Roger Summers, who was the curator of the ancient research here in Southern Africa, he then estimated with the latest technology and wrote some books about it, that there were about 20,000 of these stone structures throughout Southern Africa. And that's when I became aware of it and started realizing that, you know, we live in a land of Indiana Jones here. You know, this is real ruined territory.
Oh, sure. Wow.
And then by 2007, after writing Slave Species of God, where I do refer to some extent to these ancient civilizations in Southern Africa, mm-hmm. But without any specific physical evidence, mm-hmm. shortly after I released Slave Species of God, I was introduced to phenomenal aerial photography of these stone structures by a chap by the name called Johann Heiner, mm-hmm. who I then started working with extensively for a few years following that. And Johann had been photographing these stone structures from the air for about 15 years at that stage and trying to bring it to the attention of the authorities and the historians and archaeologists and the universities, and nobody was paying any attention to it. It was absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. He was just completely ignored.
Wow.
While presenting spectacular photography that has never been seen before of mysterious stone structures, circular stone structures, ruins, that cover vast parts of Southern Africa, and our academics and universities were just completely ignoring it. And it was in 2003 that Johann also accidentally rediscovered what then I called Adam's calendar, and not realizing that this was an ancient, well-known African site, a highly energetic site, very significant in shamanic tradition and shamanic rituals by knowledge keepers of ancient African knowledge and tradition. And then this became the incredible journey of discovery that led to realizing that we're dealing with a vanished civilization that left behind more than 10 million stone structures, these stone circles.
Wow.
Covering Southern Africa. And you know, when you realize that it's not 4,000 or 20,000 or 100,000, but it's more than 10 million.
My goodness.
We immediately realize that we're dealing with an incredible history that we know absolutely nothing about.
Hmm.
And for me personally, it has also been an incredible journey of discovery, making small step incremental breakthroughs on my journey from, you know, believing that these were dwellings for people or animals like all the others had until I came along, and then realizing within about 12 months of doing the research that we're dealing with something far more mysterious than just dwellings for people or animals or cows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often these stone structures are referred to as cattle kraal or enclosures for cows. That were built by the ancients, and I realized that this had nothing to do with dwellings for people or animals, and started finding more and more evidence that led to a deeper understanding of sound and resonance and frequency, specifically sound, and the fact that the stones have very strong acoustic properties that make up the walls of these ruins. and collecting tools and artifacts that are all connected and just keep expanding the knowledge and the evidence that we're dealing with an advanced civilization that used sound and silicon-based tools, technology, quartz-filled tools as advanced tools in an ancient form of silicon-based technology that works with sound and resonance on a very, very high level of understanding.
Oh, that is just so interesting.
Yeah. Sorry, that was a long introduction, but I'll let you run off with some thoughts, ideas that you have before I just...
Well, I want to apologize because I misread some of this information, and I thought there was 10 million years ago, 10 million stone runes, but you said that this was a... what's the time frame of these ruins? How far back do they go, Michael?
Well, you know, many of these ruins were used until recently by African tribes and other inhabitants, other migrating people that were moving throughout southern Africa. So, of course, if you come across a beautiful big stone structure with walls, you'll use it as an enclosure or put a roof on it or use mm-hmm. it for yourself. So they were used until recently, even in the South African War and the Great Trek in the 1820s. You know, it was like the pioneers in the USA going from the East Coast to the West. Same mm-hmm. thing in South Africa in the 1820s. There was a huge migration from Cape Town up north towards Johannesburg and towards mm-hmm. the other parts of South Africa. And many of those people would use these structures and renovate them and adjust them for their needs. But then you see evidence of usage as well of these stone circles by a group of people known as the Makomati people. Makomati people who are Dravidians from southern India and Sri Lanka who were here. And the evidence, once again, shows that these Dravidian Makomati people who were gold miners and gold merchants and traders who were mining gold and trading with gold as far back as 3,000 years ago here in southern Africa.
Wow, amazing.
And doing trade with India and Sri Lanka and the East and the Middle East and so forth. And none of this is in our history books, of course.
Sure.
And you have to go to independent researchers and independent books that were published by researchers to find this information. And it's staggering. And then it goes much further back in time. And then I realized once I started picking up the tools and the artifacts and studying the patina growth, and the patina is this funny skin on that grows. It's a form of crystallization, really. When the stones break, the stones that were used to make the tools and the artifacts that I've been collecting, that stone has this patina that grows on it once it breaks. And the patina is oxidization and crystallization that forms from the outside and also from the inside of the stone. But the patina grows very, very slowly. You know, it grows 1,000 years per microscopic layers. So when you've got a tool or an artifact that was clearly made by somebody a long time ago and it is covered in patina that's several millimeters thick, it clearly tells us that this is an artifact that's, you know, 100,000 years and more in age. So many of these tools and artifacts are probably around 300,000 years old, and they vary. Some of them are reasonably new that were used until very recently, but many of them are extremely old. And like I said, my estimate at this stage is around the 300,000 year mark is the original boundary of when some of these would have been made.
I'd like to tie this back into your wonderful book called Slave Species of the Gods, and the secondary title is The Secret History of the Anunnaki and Their Mission on Earth. Do you think we were genetically made made back then? I'd love your opinion on that.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You know, if you speak to geneticists that know what they're talking about and actually understand the DNA and how it works and what it does and how it's structured, they make no secret of the fact that our DNA is a patchwork of genetic material, that our mm-hmm. DNA is not an evolution of genetic material, that it is definitely a cloned DNA structure.
Mm-hmm.
And all history books, all ancient civilizations tell us that we come from the stars, that we were created by the gods. Not necessarily all of them tell us that we were created by the gods, but they all tell us we come from the stars. And some of them are very, very particular and very clear in telling us that we are created by the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And these gods, in most instances, end up being these beings called the Anunnaki, who are the reason why we're here. The more you look into it, the more you study it. All of the Sumerian text history is filled with stories of the Anunna gods, the gods of heaven and earth, the Anunnaki.
Mm-hmm.
So it's of heaven and earth. And it's spectacular. You just cannot get away from it. And the fascinating thing is that I've been studying the work of Anton Parks, who's a French researcher whose work is absolutely spectacular. And his knowledge of the Sumerian language is, in my opinion, at this stage, unsurpassed. He really has somehow connected psychically, spiritually, consciously, and scientifically to really understanding the Sumerian language and decoding it in ways that very few have done so.
Mm-hmm.
And highlights some of the inconsistencies or inaccuracies in Zachariah Sitchin's work. Not that Sitchin was doing things, was saying or misleading us, but like everyone, you know, you find information and you reach conclusions based on your current level of understanding and knowledge. I do the same. If I find a tool, some of the tools and artifacts that I found 7 years ago, I have now completely had to remodify and change my point of view and my ideas as to what these things are and what they were used for. So,
sure.
So this is how we evolve and how we grow our knowledge by constantly recognizing that things we may have believed before are no longer so, and we have to constantly change our opinion or reformulate our opinions based on the knowledge and information that we gain.
Well,
so Anton Parks' work is spectacular, and also there's no doubt about it that his entire work is filled with the story of the creation of the human race as a slave race. And the Anunnaki are the central beings that are behind this manipulation.
Interesting. Now, I remember reading Sitchin's books, A Wonderful Man Who Passed Away, I believe, a year or two ago. And he said that the...
In 2010, I think.
Some years ago. Time goes fast. And I had read about his works that the Anunnaki actually had engineered humans on this planet to be like a worker bees to mine gold for them, to bring it to their home planet, because they were losing their atmosphere and they needed to mine this gold and bring it to their home planet, Michael, and then spread it throughout their atmosphere so they could keep their atmosphere. And it's fascinating to read about that because you've included some wonderful chapters about that too in your own analysis in your Slave Species of the Gods book. But do you think that's how and why we have a fascination with gold today, why it's held in such high esteem?
Oh, absolutely. It's because of the fact that the Anunnaki were obsessed with gold.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a drug to them,
mm-hmm.
a drug for longevity of life and elevation of consciousness. And I think eventually it led to that because of what they did doesn't necessarily mean that they were highly conscious. They just had knowledge of advanced technology,
sure.
and how to use it and manipulate it for their own benefit. The whole story of the gold being used in the atmosphere, I think that is where Zachariah Sitchin possibly misinterpreted some of the mm-hmm. some of the translations,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to be moving in a slightly more sinister direction about why the gold was used,
mm.
Because you know it's not about the gold, the shiny gold, the gold as we know it, but it's about the monoatomic form of gold, the white powder of gold.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Or the ormus.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about the white powder of gold, but the gold as we know it is the dense concentrated form of it. So from that you can make vast amounts of monoatomic gold that will fill halls and fill you know rugby fields and And one bar of gold, you can make an insane amount of white powder of gold. That's where the real breakthrough understanding of our manipulation and abuse as a species begins.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, our obsession for gold as humans comes from the gods, comes from the Anunnaki. And also keep in mind, when the explorers from Europe, or we should really call them the thugs from Europe, started invading the free world some 500 years ago on their ships,
mm-hmm.
and just claiming the land for themselves and for the crown and the royal bloodlines in Europe, they came across vast quantities of gold wherever they landed, whether it was in North America, South America, Africa, Asia, wherever they went, the people had huge amounts of gold. Mm-hmm. And every time they asked, where does the gold come from? Who does the gold belong to?
Mm-hmm.
It was always the same answer. The gold belongs to the gods.
Interesting.
It's not our gold.
Interesting. I have to ask you, Michael, you have a fascinating section in your Slave Species of the Gods book about religion. And do you think religion was created by the same Anunnaki to help to control humanity?
Oh, absolutely. Religion is an absolute tool of control.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you read the Bible specifically, you start seeing this is what I call, you know, in Slave Species of God, or Slave Species of the Gods, which it was called in the most recent publication by Bear & Co., or Inner Traditions. I draw the distinction between God with a big G, or the creator of everything, the creator of all things in existence, and the gods with a small G, or the Elohim, or the Anunnaki, or the Anakim, those that ran amok and abused humanity, created genetically cloned a species for their personal need and their personal abuse, and to treat as slaves. And that is just an absolute no-no in the higher spectrum of consciousness of creation.
Right.
That you can't do that. You know, as conscious beings, evolved beings, that's just not done. And in fact, you know, Star Trek has a lot to say about this. Star Trek calls it the Prime Directive.
Right.
And Star Trek refers to it as, you cannot breach the Prime Directive. You cannot interfere with the evolution of a species. And this is exactly what the Anunnaki did.
Well,
they not only interfered with the evolution of a species, they created a species purely to be a slave race.
And I have to tell you, this I want to share with you. This is a message that I wasn't able to fully read on air earlier, but I'd like to just two sentences of this message I received from Norway this morning from this person who's been in contact with the Andromedans. And they've asked me to read this. They said that... those who govern us on Earth, and I think what you're talking about still goes on today, that there are many entities on this planet who want to make us into a slave race. But, quote, those who govern us on this planet are aware of that we are waking up, and they want to stop this awakening. Because if we wake up, they will no longer be masters of a slave species for their own benefit. They want to continue being the supreme controlling power on top of the food pyramid of greed and violence. It's very interesting. And I think I just wanted to share that with you. That came in this morning from Norway, from the Andromedans. So,
yeah, yeah.
Fits in exactly
and
what you're saying.
You know, the Anunnaki are a very interesting group of beings. And within them, within their own structure and hierarchy and civilization, they're equally... In fact, if you look at the human race, we probably, in many ways, echo the makeup of the Anunnaki themselves. I'm talking socially socioeconomically. You got the more conscious Anunnaki, you got the dumber Anunnaki, you got the violent Anunnaki, you got the peaceful Anunnaki, and we seem to be a mirror image of exactly who they were. And when they cloned us and created us into the species, we evolved and grew into what they were at that stage.
Sure.
But this is a long time ago. This is like 300,000 years ago, maybe a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So in that time, the Anunnaki themselves have evolved consciously. Mm-hmm. And we certainly have evolved consciously. And there's a lot more to be said about how this happened and why it happened and what capacity was put into our DNA.
Sure.
You know, why is it that we only use 3% of our DNA and now suddenly we're using more and more of our DNA? And
right.
The more we use, the more conscious we are, the more we wake up, the more powers we get, the more we can manifest with our thoughts and minds and
right.
and our pineal gland and our words. And so we grow into these powerful beings, which we are meant to be. In fact, many of the researchers that you look at, and I'm sure you probably are aware of it, is that, you know, we have encoded in our DNA all the knowledge and information of everything in creation. That is encoded in our DNA.
Wow.
That is the knowledge we should all possess.
Mm-hmm.
But that knowledge, that's in the so-called junk DNA that our ignorant scientists have been calling.
That's right.
And that's where all the good stuff is. So as we start accessing the vast knowledge and information encoded in our DNA, we become very powerful beings.
Right.
We become supermen and superwomen. And we can do everything because we are part of the Creator. We are one with the Creator. And this is where the messages from people like Jesus Christ, whoever he may have been, because there's so much confusion around that individual in any case,
right.
but whoever Jesus may have been, mm-hmm. you know, when you read things like, remember, God is within you, you are one with God. You know, that mm-hmm. is completely misunderstood and misread by preachers and those that preach the Bible. It's telling you that you resonate with the source code energy of the Creator, that it is in you, and you have the same capacity because you are an infinite fractal of the Creator.
Michael, this entire studio now has just become very, very bright white light, and I know my angel friends are here, and they're all applauding you for saying that, but please continue.
Yeah, well, thanks for telling me that. It just highlights that, you know, when you tap into this knowledge, this channel of information, and it's a resonance that you know in your heart. When you tap into that, it's like plugging into the mainframe,
right?
And you know this is it, and you start feeling the deceptions and recognizing the deceptions that right. surround us or that are fed to us by the media and the governments.
Right.
And it becomes a lot easier to see the deceptions and recognize them. It also becomes a lot easier to recognize the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where I get very excited, because that's where my research into ancient human history and origins of humankind and all that dark, horrible, dark stuff which many people can't deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the terrible truth. Mm-hmm. That we have to face and we have to come to terms with before we can move on.
Mm-hmm.
Because that terrible truth, as horrible and as dark as it is, forms the foundation for our unity and our strength, from which we're going to build a new humanity, a new civilization, a new way forward for humanity, based on a foundation of knowledge and truth that we know we can never go back to.
Right.
And it points us very clearly in the direction that we should be taking. So what I've also started doing is not to point fingers at these people, not to point fingers at the Anunnaki,
mm-hmm.
And say, you are so horrible and nasty to us. Look how evil you are and all this. Rather say, and you know, and that goes to the corporations and the megalomaniacs out there and the banking families that control the world.
Right.
And those that are these evil corporations and evil if you can use the word evil, I don't like using that word at all, but
sure.
you know, the dark energies that are just
forces,
doing everything in their power to enslave humanity and keep us enslaved.
Right.
The game is up, and right. we've got to say thank you, because it's really the last 6,000 years when the enslavement, 6 to 10,000 years after the flood, that period specifically, you can really start seeing it kick off around 6,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
in the Sumerian text. That's where the information comes from. We got to thank them for showing us that this is not the way. So they've been our teachers. They've been our, by being the slave masters and the oppressors and those that have committed unimaginable atrocities against humanities and waged the wars and
sure.
And created the misery, they've been our teachers
mm-hmm.
to say, this is not the way. And mm-hmm. now I feel we are, especially through the Ubuntu movement and the messages and the downloads and the information that I've been given. I'm just the messenger. The knowledge and that information is not mine. Somehow I've been able to take the information and put it into a palatable, presentable way that presents a very simple plan of action for a prosperous and an abundant future. And that's what drives me. That's what excites me. And I suppose that's what excites so many other people when they find us and they find a plan for a future of utopian future of abundance beyond belief.
Well, I have to tell you something very interesting, Michael, that the software that I use on my computer system, it's a Linux-based system called Ubuntu.
Yes.
And
yeah,
it's a free platform, but it's absolutely incredible. It doesn't crash. There's no problems with it. Very happy with it.
Yeah, that was created by another South African guy called Mark Shuttleworth.
Mm-hmm.
So the South Africans are already playing a prominent role in this new age that we are already in.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
One thing I forgot to mention earlier was that Adam's calendar is, as I mentioned, is well known by the knowledge keepers of ancient African history and mm-hmm. knowledge. And Kreda Mutwa is one of them, obviously, probably the most well-known Zulu shaman mm-hmm. in southern Africa. And Kreda was initiated at Adam's calendar in 1937. I think he was about 16 at that stage, as a young shaman. And he made it very clear that Adam's calendar, he calls it Inzalo Yelanga. It's known in Zulu, Inzalo Yelanga, which means mm-hmm. birthplace of the sun, and not necessarily the sun as in the sun in the sky, but mm-hmm. the sun of the gods, the sons of the gods, where humanity was created by the gods to be the slaves in the gold mines.
Interesting.
That's what it's known as.
Interesting. Fascinating, fascinating. Well, I agree with you, Michael, that I think our future is very bright indeed, because that's our destiny to wake up and as time goes on, I think more and more people are waking up, and I also think that this is a time of truth, where things that are true become even more self-evident, and those things which are negative or not meant to be will fall by the wayside, and But keep talking, Michael. I'm really enjoying listening to you.
Oh, well, I don't want to just talk. I'm sure you have some ideas or questions or something that you want to bring up. So if there's anything you'd like me to cover, please do. Otherwise, I can rattle on for hours.
Okay.
Know?
Well, there was one point. You had a long section in your book about Enlil and Enki. One of them, this is the ancient Anunnaki, one who wanted to help humanity on this planet. The other one wanted to enslave us. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about that for those who are unfamiliar with them?
Yeah, Enlil and Enki are well known to those that study the Sumerian texts and specifically Zechariah Sitchin. But the plot thickens, you know. When you study Anton Parks' work, for example, it turns out that Enlil was not necessarily Enki's brother, but was actually like his offspring, who was also a clone. What also becomes evident is that pretty much all these beings, including the Anunnaki, and all the other beings that have been coming and going on this planet, many of them actually cloned species themselves. And this is a huge discovery that I've made relatively recently.
Mm-hmm.
And that does begin to explain the traumatic enslavement and the traumatic conditions on our planet
mm-hmm.
That we've been exposed to. And again, that is resonant with the information you get from a book that is taken many people by surprise,
mm-hmm.
Called Alien Interview, which is written by a young, at the time, I think she was 24 or 25. She was the only woman present at the Roswell crash in mm-hmm. 1947. And she was then the one that interviewed the being, the ET that they captured there, for about, I think it was 6 weeks that she interviewed him, and and then went home and wrote down as much as she could. I forget what her name is, Matilda, I think somebody. And then she released that book when she died. It was released, I think it was about in the late, very late 90s or early, or could have been early 2000s, that her book was finally released. And it's called Alien Interview. And it's phenomenal what you read in there, because much of what this ISBE, this this ET calls itself an ISBE, what it says is very resonant with what Anton Parks talks about in his research from the Sumerian texts and the Anunnaki, and his understanding of the Sumerian language. And it's the fact that these beings, it's like watching Star Wars, really. It's like watching Star Wars. And these beings of all shapes and sizes that just fly around and make their way through the universe and the galaxies and just cause havoc, take over planets, go to war, create hierarchical structures and corporations, and set up this and build military, build up military and weaponry and they call it the domain that consists of hundreds of galaxies, if not thousands of galaxies, and solar systems and planets.
Wow.
And it's just this control system that is just vast.
Sure.
And Earth fell, became a victim of this domain and this, and these nasty malicious beings that operate on a corporate hierarchical warring structure that, that deals with competition and treaties and contracts and all this stuff. And that's exactly what's imposed on us on this planet.
Sure.
While none of that is necessary, while, you know, everything that we promote with the Ubuntu movement moves directly in the opposite direction, away from control, away from corporate structure, away from competition and greed and money, and moves into an area of cooperation and collaboration where money is not needed, where we collaboratively and together create abundance beyond our wildest imagination.
I've been in touch with the Galactic Alliance for the nearly 2 years now, and they're here now as we speak. And they said that on a normal human planet outside of this one, Michael, that people live for approximately 1,000 years. Although in the Andromeda Galaxy, humans live an average of 3,000 years. And also, money is not used. People help each other, and they. It may be hard for many people around the world to think how a society could exist and function properly if you don't have money as an exchange. But people do, they barter and then they help each other out, and so money is not needed. It's very interesting what you're saying, and it fits into what how other humans and other advanced civilizations outside of Earth live.
Yeah, look, I go into a lot of detail about the society without money and how you don't need money and you don't need barter or trade or exchange of any form. That is still part of a control system. Remember, any form of exchange or bartering or trade or any form of money, whether it's cows or chickens or eggs or bits of silver or pieces of paper, somebody will find a way to use and abuse that system and manipulate others for their benefit at the expense of everyone else.
Sure.
So with the Ubuntu movement, I have been very, very vocal about getting that message across. And it's amazing how people, you know, at first don't get it, or they're very confused and very wary or suspicious about how we could operate without any form of exchange. And then as they start to break down the walls or the prison bars of our indoctrination and our and our manipulation on this planet throughout our education system and our entire socioeconomic structure, because that's all we've ever been exposed to is everything revolves around money. So we can't imagine something outside of that. And yet, when you start imagining a world without money, and that's exactly what I did in 2005, when I realized that in ancient times, money didn't exist. And people lived for thousands of years. In fact, people lived for much, much longer without money than we have lived with money for the last 6,000 years or so.
Fascinating.
And when you start imagining what it would be like to live without money, it becomes a most exciting journey of discovery and self-growth, because you really have to challenge yourself. And that's the journey that I took for 11 years now. I started in 2005 thinking what would happen if we just didn't have any money. How would we survive?
Sure.
And I must tell you, it truly is an absolutely exciting journey of discovery.
Fascinating, Michael.
As you start figuring out how we've been manipulated and lied to and controlled through the money system.
Michael, let's say I have a time machine, and I'm going to put you in it now, and you're going to transport yourself, let's say, 50 to 100 years from now. If we make the right choices, what kind of future do you think we have?
It's very difficult for me to imagine what will happen at that stage, but obviously we will be in a world where money does not exist. We live in communities of choice, where you choose to live, not where you're forced to live because you got a job there.
Right.
So you've got to move from city to city because, you know, otherwise you can't survive. So that no longer applies. We're living in communities where you choose to live. We'll have advanced technology that we can't even imagine today because suddenly money is not a hurdle to create new technology, and people, corporations don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
People work together and independently and in groups to create, to innovate, and everything that we create and innovate is used for the benefit of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that is not the case. Today, people work for corporations, and anything you discover and invent then belongs to the corporation, who then uses it for profit, for the benefit of the corporation at the expense of the people.
Right.
And this is why, you know, free electricity devices and cures for cancer and all this kind of stuff and other alternatives to petroleum are not released, because that is not good for the corporations that control those industries. So it's very obvious what's going on. So in a world without money, all that changes.
Mm-hmm.
So a utopian society, and I always remind people, utopian is a good word. Let's use it all the time. I want to live in a utopian society, in a utopian community, right?
Don't
think it's a bad word.
Right.
And where we will live in communities of our own choice, where the technology will be so advanced that we can't even recognize it today, where we're not going to use cars to move around, where we'll probably be teleporting or moving in some other ways, or we will still have cars, but they'll be driven as more for fun, to experience G-force and gravity and so forth, but not as a means of transportation. And I deal with many of these issues in my Ubuntu book, Ubuntu Contributionism. So, and what would happen, you know, and how things will change.
Sure, sure.
And
absolutely.
The answer is, everything changes. The moment you remove money from the system, everything changes instantly. Where we live, how we live, what we do, how we eat, how we grow food.
Sure.
Food, what kind of food we grow,
Michael,
the technology we have,
sure.
how we travel, how we interact in relationships,
sure,
how
sure,
we enter into relationships,
sure, sure.
Marriage, that kind of stuff will
sure.
fall away, because that's also a construct created by government and church.
Interesting. Michael, we've got about a little more than a minute left, and I wanted to ask you really quick. I'm sure you've heard of this gentleman called Valiant Thor. He visited, there was the movie that came out a couple of years ago called Stranger at the Pentagon, where he visited President Eisenhower in 1957, stayed at the Pentagon for 3 years, and offered technology and spiritual advancement to President Eisenhower for a cashless society which would eliminate poverty and disease on this planet as well. But unfortunately, Eisenhower turned it down. But have you heard of him, by the way?
I did hear about that, and obviously I'm not surprised it was turned down. It wasn't the time.
Sure.
It was way before.
Right.
The time is now. We are now in the new age, and we are the ones we've been waiting for.
Right.
That's what I tell everybody. So go out there, tell everyone you know, become a seed of consciousness in your own area, join the Ubuntu movement, find out what we're doing, our plan of action that is so very, very simple, specifically coming to the South African elections now in 2016, All we need to do is win one little municipality, and that will become the first domino to fall.
Michael,
because as a mayor,
we're running out of time, my friend. I'm so thankful you could come on the show today. I'd love to have you back on again, my friend. And thank you so much again for coming on. Please stay tuned for our next hour with Randy Kramer from the Mars Secret Space Program.